Welcome to Kingsley Napoli podcast. We are aiming in this session to disentangle various strands of the law for medics so that they can understand exactly what each area of medical law entails in three succinct need-to-know nuggets. First up, Shanette Thompson from the regulatory perspective.
The first thing that doctors need to be aware of is that the General Medical Council as a regulator is not out to get them. Their primary purpose, obviously in relation to patients, is to promote patient safety. So quite clearly, they need to deal with any complaints which are made to them. But any complaint which is made to the GMC, clients are always concerned that that is going to lead to action being taken against them. And they always are concerned that it's going to result in some type of erasure of their registration, which is simply not the case when you look at the statistics. A vast majority of the complaints that are made to the GMC are closed without any action because they do look at the principles of right touch regulation when it comes to complaints that are made.
Okay, that's great. So point one, regulators not out to get you. What would your second point be?
The second point is that if a complaint is made against you, obviously remain calm. It is a stressful time, but do not do anything that will jeopardise your position. I would be lying if I said that clients have not before done things that have caused their position to be even more serious than it would have otherwise been had they remained calm, taken proper advice at the outset. So remain calm, do not do anything such as tampering with any notes or any evidence, because those are the things that are going to be key in any investigation.
Okay, so that's really interesting. So point two, don't panic. What about your third point?
The third point in terms of dealing with the regulator is to be open. Engage, obviously give them what they need in terms of investigating any complaint, but do get proper advice about engaging with the regulator. It is a stressful time and it's something that you shouldn't do on your own. So make sure you've either got advice from a medical defence organisation or from a regulatory lawyer like myself.
Okay, so be open and engage with the process. Marvellous, thank you very much indeed. Okay, next up we have Poonam Sood, who's going to give us a take from the perspective of the civil lawyer. So Poonam, from the perspective of the clinical negligence lawyer, what are the three points that you would like to convey to the medics?
Well, the first thing is that in a claim like this, there's no jury, there'll be no guilty verdict in a courtroom. It's decided by a single judge for either the claimant, who's the person bringing the claim, or for the defendant, which is usually the trust. The other thing is that it's important to remember that a doctor who's employed by a trust won't be the defendant in a clinical negligence claim. They won't be named on court papers. The claim will be against the trust for whom you work. The only thing to add to that is that if you're a doctor who's acting in a private capacity in a private hospital, for example, at the Bupa or Spire hospitals, the claim would be against you, and so it's important to have adequate insurance through your medical defence organisations.
Okay, and is it a career-ending event?
No, absolutely not.
Okay, thank you. That's very reassuring. So what would your second point be?
The second point I'd like to say is that clinical negligence claims are actually quite difficult to prove. There are some legal tests that you need to overcome to be successful in a clinical negligence claim. The first thing is known as breach of duty. This means that a patient needs to prove that the standard of care that was given was below the prevailing standard at the time. The second test is known as the causation test, which means that the harm suffered by a patient must be shown on the balance of probabilities to be directly linked with the doctor not meeting the standard that was required.
Okay, that's really helpful guidance on the test, thank you. Now, I think your third point relates to what doctors might do to protect themselves from claims.
The most important thing is good note-taking. It's very difficult to criticise a well-thought-out and clearly documented management plan that appears in someone's notes. Assuming that plan was reasonable and it shows all the options that were considered and the risks weighed up with the patient, and that patient's had the opportunity to ask questions, it makes it very difficult to then go on to criticise it.
Okay, that's great. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
The next person that I'm going to talk to is Francesca Lopez from our employment team, who is going to talk to us about how you blow the whistle. So, Francesca, your sort of three key points on that, please.
I would say There are a couple of key things that people need to be bearing in mind. My first kind of key point would be that to the extent possible, people should be trying to raise their concerns internally with their employer in the first instance. Now, where they feel unable to do so or can't for whatever reason, then I think it's important to be raising their concerns with a relevant regulatory body such as the GMC or perhaps another appropriate authority like the BMA, HEE or the CQC, for example. I think it's also worth noting that to the extent possible, people ought to be complying with any relevant whistleblowing policies. So their employer may have one in place, for example, or there may be a regulatory whistleblowing policy of the GMC. A final point I would note is that people need to be providing a sufficient level of detail in relation to their whistleblow. So that will include things like an explanation of their concerns, being dates, times, what actually happened, who else may have been involved, who perhaps witnessed the matter. It will also include details of the alleged failures or likely failures which may be taking place. If an individual is alleging a breach of a legal obligation, it may be helpful to state the source of that legal obligation. And also, if there are relevant documents, then it may be worth providing copies of those documents too.
Great. Okay, so just sort of to summarise, your first point was around making sure that you're reporting to the right person or the right regulatory body.
Yep.
Making sure, secondly, that you comply with the procedures of your employer.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, making sure that there's a sufficiently detailed account that you give, and that's really aimed at protecting yourself as the whistleblower.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, lovely. Thanks very much indeed. Now we have my colleague Sarah Burton to talk about inquests. Sarah, welcome. What would your three points be for doctors to be aware of if they're thinking about the medical law relating to inquests?
Well, I think that the first point that I would probably make clear is that an inquest itself is actually the end point of a coroner's investigation into a death which takes place. So the beginning is that a doctor must report all deaths which take place that they are involved in line with the requirements of their local senior coroner, which normally will mean that if it's not clear that it's from natural causes, it must be reported to the coroner. These deaths will then be investigated by the coroner and his officers. Some investigations will end up being closed quite quickly when it's clear what has taken place. A proportion of those inquests will result in a formal inquest hearing, which takes place at the end of the investigations. And this will be inside a courtroom. They can go on for quite a long time. There will be a coroner sitting, and sometimes, rarely, also a jury.
Okay, so important takeaway point, not all deaths result in an inquest. Thank you. What's your next point?
My second point is that inquests are not supposed to be an adversarial hearing. They're supposed to be a fact-finding exercise undertaken by the coroner. Unfortunately, and probably unsurprisingly, inquests can end up being very adversarial, and that's especially the case where it's suspected that there's been mistakes or possibly negligence which have led to the death of a patient. And their family will want to know and get to the bottom of how that death took place.
Okay, so the inquest is an inquisitorial process rather than adversarial process, and so they shouldn't be too adversarial. Okay.
They shouldn't be, no.
Great. And do you have a third tip for doctors?
I suppose following on from what I've just said about the adversarial or non-adversarial nature of an inquest, my third point would be that if you find yourself involved in an inquest, and especially if it's become very difficult, you just need to remember that your duty is to assist the coroner with telling him what you know. And so in order to do that, you should try and keep notes as soon as possible, possibly draft your own statement as soon as you are aware of a death that you think may end up in it being in the subject of an inquest. And then you should try and offer those notes and that statement and everything you know to the coroner's officer as soon as you are asked, and be as proactive and honest in that respect as you can be.
Thank you very much, Sarah. So the final point is to proactively help the coroner in any way you can.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, next up we have Matthew Hardcastle. Hello. You're going to talk about the criminal perspective for the medics.
I am, and the first point I'd like to make is what to do if the police come knocking on your door. Although in and of itself that is a little antiquated, because you're now likely to get a text message or a letter through the door. The important point is to engage a lawyer right at the outset, because no matter how it is phrased, a conversation with a police officer is always a serious event. If they are investigating a criminal case and they believe that you have had any role in the gross negligence death of a patient, then they're likely to want to interview you under caution. Even if this is as a volunteer or presented as a chat, it is still a step which has the same evidential weight as an interview after arrest. It is in your interest to engage a lawyer at the earliest stage, because they will then be working with the police to try and receive pre-interview disclosure, and that is a series of documents or statements which allow you to understand why it is you are a suspect in this case. It's also important that you don't speak to the officer freely before you engage a lawyer, because anything you say to that officer may be noted by them, and once they have that note, they are likely to ask you questions on it later. And even the most innocuous statement may find itself being presented in a different form later down the line.
So you need the lawyer to protect your position is the essential message there.
Absolutely.
Okay. And what would your second thought be?
That the process of a criminal case is very long and somewhat strange and alienating for people who haven't been involved with it before. The test for the police to interview somebody is very, very low. They have an obligation to investigate matters. So simply because the police have invited you to an interview doesn't actually give you a great idea about the strength of evidence that may be there. The first stage is the investigation. That is very likely to take between about 12 months and possibly even 2 years, depending on the complexity of the case. If at the end of that investigation, the police have drawn together their file and submitted it to the Crown Prosecution Service, and the Crown Prosecution Service have conducted the full code test, that is, they've decided that there is sufficient evidence for a reasonable prospect of conviction, and that they believe that it is in the public interest to bring a prosecution, then a charge will follow. The test at that stage is reasonable prospect of conviction. That's essentially the same as the test in civil matters. It's whether or not it's more likely that a conviction would follow. That is a very different test to the test that will be applied by a jury in a criminal case, as a jury will have to be satisfied so that they are sure, in old money, sure beyond reasonable doubt. If you put that roughly into numbers, the test for charging, you'd be looking at 51-52%. If you're looking at the test for a conviction, you'd be looking at around the 95-96% level. The jury would have to be sure. It's also important to remember that the police will gather as much information as possible, and that will include any accounts that you have given either in previous internal investigations or in any regulatory proceedings or in any other way. So it's very important that as soon as you become aware that a criminal case is started, you have that lawyer instructed, and you are able to provide them with, as best as you can recall, a list of all the accounts you've given and where they may be found.
Okay, so again, the need for the lawyer's support is really to navigate you through what's a very complex process with different standards of proof. I hear what you're saying, which is that the ultimate standard of proof, if it gets to a criminal trial, is very, very high. But there are stages before that during the investigation where you will need legal guidance.
Yes, absolutely right. And it's very unnerving when you start passing those various thresholds and you're unaware of the standard, because people assume that the standard in a criminal case is the beyond reasonable doubt all the way through. But actually, it's much more staged than
so
that.
So the involvement of a lawyer will be inherently reassuring.
Absolutely.
That's really good to know. And talk to me about your third point.
The third point is simply to go over the test that would be applied by a prosecution and by a court in a matter of gross negligence manslaughter. The offence requires the prosecution to prove, so that is to make sure the jury are satisfied so that they are sure all five elements exist. The first is that the defendant owed an existing duty of care to the victim. In the case of a doctor and patient relationship, that will almost certainly be the case. The second is that the defendant negligently breached that duty of care. The third is that it was reasonably foreseeable that the breach of that duty gave rise to a serious and obvious risk of death. And it's important here to pause and say the foreseeability is on the basis of what the defendant knew at that stage, and also that the breach of duty has to give rise to a serious and obvious risk of death, not simply serious injury. The fourth element is that the breach has to cause the death of the victim. And the final element, and the fifth element, is that the circumstance of the breach were truly exceptionally bad and so reprehensible as to justify the conclusion that it amounted to gross negligence and required criminal sanction. You'll see that test, truly exceptionally bad, is the level of the breach that is required before a conviction will follow.
Okay, so I think that's a really useful summary, and that final point again reiterates how high the bar is for the prosecution to pass over, and hopefully medics will find that reassuring. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Okay, that brings this podcast to an end. If you require further information, please do look at our website, where you'll also find our insights and contact details should you wish to speak to a member of the team.